Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. My name is Alyssa Fitzgerald, and I'm counsel at Goodwin Proctor, and Natalie Chadbury, an associate also at Goodwin, is my co-presenter today. And I believe this is the second in the fundamental series for tax-exempt organizations. And we're going to talk today about how to form a tax-exempt organization. We'll go over a little bit in the beginning about what it means to be a C3, which might be somewhat of a review for those of you that attended last week. And then we will get into more of the nuts and bolts of how you actually form the entity and apply for tax exempt status, and then go over some of the other registration and reporting requirements. So the first bit is sort of just a quick reminder on what it means to be a 501c3 entity, tax exempt entity. Section 501c3 is a section in the Internal Revenue Code, and there are a couple of requirements that are set forth in the code itself on what an organization has to be to obtain tax-exempt status. The first is that it must be organized and operated exclusively for charitable purposes. And there are some instances when, the reason it says primarily in parentheses is there are some instances when you might be able to do things sort of outside that purpose, but be subject to other rules. And that's sort of outside the scope of today's topic, but some of the other fundamental sessions will cover that. But exclusively, to be organized, that means that your charitable purpose needs to be set forth in your organizational documents. So in your trust document or your article of organization, you will state what that purpose is and why it fits within, and that it fits within 501c3 charitable purposes. And those purposes are generally educational, scientific, literary, religious, or sort of the broad charitable, but it must sort of be within one of those or within one of the other purposes enumerated in the IRS regulations. It must also be operated exclusively for charitable purposes. So all of the activities of the 501c3 entity should be in furtherance of those charitable purposes. And in fact, the IRS requires that your organizational documents state or that it be a requirement under your state law that when the 501c3 organization dissolves or winds down, any assets remaining go to another C3 for similar purposes. So it must at all times be operated for charitable purposes. The second requirement is that it may not benefit any private individual. So 501c3 organizations do not have any shares or shareholders or sort of any profits that would go to an individual or private benefit. All of the assets go back into the charitable purpose. And this is not to say that employees of the organization cannot make reasonable salaries commensurate with their experience level, their geographic location. A very large 501c3 can pay fairly large salaries depending on what its revenues are and what the employees are doing. But all of those must sort of be reasonable. People cannot receive anything over and above that. The third is that it must benefit a charitable class. So the 501c3 should benefit the public generally. When you think about organizations that are charities and benefiting the public, schools, churches, charities, they're not benefiting a finite number of individuals. And you can think of an organization, if your neighbor's house burns down and you want to set up a fund to help them rebuild their house, that might sort of fall within the loose definition of being charitable. But because that is benefiting a small number of individuals and not a larger charitable class, that would not qualify as a 501c3. But you could set up a charity that could benefit individuals who, have financial need and have suffered from a natural disaster, for example, and your neighbor or someone else might fit within that category. I like to think of this as that if you can't write down the number of people that you are going to benefit. It has to be a broad enough class that it's sort of indefinite. And the third requirement is that 501c3 may not conduct political campaign activity and can only conduct a limited amount of lobbying. 501c3s are strictly prohibited from engaging in political campaign activity, either for or in opposition to a candidate for office. And that includes anything from local to national level, anyone running for public office. So you need to be really careful, you know, if your mission starts to get really close to a topic that becomes, you know, a heated debate in a political campaign, that you're careful around how you use that language and making sure that you're not supporting a candidate. Organizations can conduct bipartisan activities. So you can do get out the vote drives, or you could technically invite candidates to come speak, as long as you're inviting all of the candidates. And it's nonpartisan, but you need to be pretty careful when it comes to anything involving anyone running for public office. And 501c3s can conduct a limited, non-substantial amount of lobbying. Again, this is opposing or supporting any legislation. And if your organization does want to do lobbying activities, there's two sort of tests that you can do to make sure that you are within, that you're not, your lobbying doesn't rise to the level of being substantial. One is sort of a general substantiality test, and the other is actually a qualitative test that you can elect to have measuring sort of your lobbying expenditures against your regular charitable 501c3 expenditures to show the IRS that you really fall within the permissible limits. So again, just quick reminders that if you are doing anything sort of coming close to political campaigns or any lobbying, you want to make sure that you're checking those rules and staying within the permitted guidelines. Under the 501c3 umbrella, there are two basic classifications. There are private foundations, which is the default, and there are public charities. I know that there's a later fundamentals program specifically devoted to private foundations because there are different rules and slightly more restrictive rules that apply to private foundations, because private foundations are what you would think of, you know, the Gates Foundation, the Nike Foundation. There are organizations, charities that are predominantly funded by one or two sources, a family, a corporation. And because of that, because they're not funded by the public, they have some more strict rules about transactions with insiders, some small net investment taxes that they are required to pay, and other requirements. We have default in parentheses there, because when you apply to the IRS for 501c3 status, you have to prove that you are a public charity, if that is what you want your classification to be. And most operating charities that are conducting activities and not simply making grants want to classify it as a public charity, because again, there's fewer rules applying to public charities. This chart shows the three ways that you could qualify for public charity status. The first is that you qualify automatically, which certain organizations are just inherently benefiting the public. Churches, schools, or hospitals are three examples. The second is that you are a supporting organization. So your organization is set up solely to support a 501c3. And there are some specific rules around how you qualify to be a supporting organization. And the third and most common is that you satisfy what is called the public support test. And again, I think this was probably covered in more depth in the first session of fundamentals, but it essentially means that you are out soliciting the public and benefiting from public donations to the extent that one third of your support is coming from qualified public sources. And any donations that you get from a single source are often capped at 2% of your total support. Again, this is a mathematical equation where you're looking at your qualified public support over your total support. And there's lots of nuances in passing that test. But the takeaway here is that if your organization, the business plan for your organization is to conduct fundraising and not just rely on a couple of foundation grants or individual grants, if you're going to do broad-based fundraising, you're probably fine and will satisfy that public support test. If you are dependent or planning to depend on only a couple of donations or grants, you might be classified as a private foundation, and you just sort of want to look at that and make sure that suits your organization, or if you are a public charity, that you're able to pass the test. Again, there's nuances with the test. It's calculated on a five-year rolling average. So you have to not pass the test 2 years in a row on the five-year rolling average to get bumped out to private foundation status. And there's also a facts and circumstances test. So if you do not meet the one-third test, but you're still Can make an argument to the IRS that you normally receive substantial public support and you're out benefiting the public, then you might also be able to pass a facts and circumstance test. But the takeaway there is that most operating 501c3s want to be in our public charities, and most of them obtain their classification as a public charity because they're passing the public support test, because they're largely supported by contributions from the public. So that was just a quick overview and background to sort of set the stage for what it means to be a 501c3. And now we're going to get into sort of how do you form an entity. So you have a client that comes to you and wants to form a charity. The first things you're going to consider when you meet with the client is, does the intended project have a charitable purpose? That's the big one. You want to make sure that whatever they plan on doing is actually a purpose that fits within those 501c3 definitions. Is the client aware of the administrative efforts needed to maintain an entity's tax-exempt status? So unlike a for-profit, there's more oversight over 501c3s. You have the IRS oversight, generally the state attorney general's oversight, as well as the corporation's division's oversight. And those, if you are fundraising outside of the state that you're operating in, you might need to register in some other states and report to those states. So there's a little more administration of charities. And reporting requirements and oversight by these entities. So is the client ready to sort of take that on? And also, if you wish to dissolve a 501c3, again, I mentioned it earlier, you have to go through a process. If you're formed in Massachusetts, you have to go through a two-step process with the AG's office and the Supreme Judicial Court to make sure that they approve how you're dissolving and where you're charitable assets are going to upon dissolution. So it's a much bigger burden than sort of a for-profit entity that's able to just pass out its assets to its shareholders and dissolve the business. Is the client aware of the need for ongoing fundraising if the entity is going to be a publicly supported charity? So that gets to passing the public support test. Do they know that you have to sort of have a model of public fundraising in order to be the public charity? And then finally, does the client need to form a new entity, or is there an existing entity that could be utilized? We often ask this question of our clients because there are so many 501c3s and so many charities out there. And we'll talk a little bit later about the formation process and the lengthy time it takes for the IRS to issue a 501c3 determination. But there might be a charity out there with a very similar mission, and the client might be able to be a project, you know, under that organization, or work with that organization to achieve the client's goals, and perhaps, you know, combine forces and combine resources. And that might be more beneficial than starting their own organization. There are some alternatives. Today we're gonna focus on forming a nonprofit corporation or a trust. But there are some alternatives again to forming a separate entity, to be a public charity. One is that a client could form a donor advised fund. And for those of you who aren't aware of it, donor advised funds, they're becoming very popular. Usually we think of them as alternatives to forming a private foundation, because it might be an individual that wants to have a grant making vehicle. And instead of taking on the burden of forming their own private foundation, they might form a donor advised fund, which is a fund within a public charity. Fidelity Charitable is a big one. There's other big ones. And essentially it is a fund that a donor can contribute funds to and advise on as to how they would like those funds distributed. Generally there's requirements that it be distributed to C3 public charities. But if the donor intends on sort of just doing grant making, that is a great alternative to sort of forming a private foundation, a private grant making foundation. An organization could find a fiscal sponsor, which is another 501c3 that the project contracts with, because they have some sort of mission alignment, and donors donate to the fiscal sponsor, which is a C3, and the fiscal sponsor then may re-grant to the project because its activities fall within the fiscal sponsor's charitable purposes. It's generally a contractual relationship. Some organizations do this while they are themselves applying to be a C3 because of the length of time it takes the IRS, but it allows your donors to donate to a 501c3 and take the deduction before you get your determination. organizations could form a benefit corporation. If they truly want to be a for-profit and not a nonprofit, they could form what's called a benefit corporation, which is a for-profit entity that is allowed to take things into consideration other than just making a profit for its shareholders. It can take environmental or social or employee considerations into consideration when making decisions about the business and not just purely profit making. Some of, I think, the more well-known benefit corporations are Patagonia, for example. I think Athleta is one where their board is sort of allowed to take things other than just pure profit making motives into consideration. And the fourth item here is to just not make a profit. So if the organization isn't going to make a profit, and all of its assets are going out, its revenues are going out, it might not owe any tax. So it might not necessarily need to become a tax exempt entity. If your client does want to go ahead and form a tax exempt 501c3, there's a couple of different routes or paths it can choose. We most often, I would say almost exclusively now, form nonprofit corporations. And whether that's in Massachusetts, which is where we're going to focus today, or in Delaware or another state, gives some having a corporate form and some bylaws and some straight state rules and regulations that sort of gives is good governance and a good guidelines for how you can run the organization. Many 501c3s are formed as trusts. I would say that's much more common in the private foundation context than the public charity context. And 501c3 could be an LLC, but there are specific rules around that as well. And usually in order to be a tax exempt LLC, because it's a pass-through entity, all of the members of the LLC must also be 501c3s for the LLC to get 501c3 status. And the organization could be an unincorporated entity. As lawyers, we generally recommend against that for various reasons, especially sort of liability protections and other concerns that might come with not being an incorporated entity. And finally, before I pass over to Natalie, just quick list of where, you know, assuming your client wants to go ahead and form the organization and we decide we're going to form a Massachusetts nonprofit corporation, this just shows some of the statutes that govern Massachusetts nonprofit corporations. Chapter 180 is the big one. It's incredibly antiquated and hasn't been updated despite some efforts over the course of the past 5 to 10 years. So that's where you're going to look. It references Chapter 156B, which is an old business corporation statute. And there are a bunch of differences between that and the new 156D, which is the current Business Corporation Act. And then you'll also see that there's certain sections that talk about the AG's oversight and involvement in the organization. 11A, for example, talks about what I alluded to, the petition for dissolution with the Attorney General and the Supreme Judicial Court. If your organization is a trust, you want to look to the Massachusetts Uniform Trust Code. And then Chapter 12 and Chapter 68 sort of talk about the AG's oversight of charities and charitable funds in Massachusetts, and then the solicitation for charitable purposes and requirements that charities that either hold funds, operate in, or solicit individuals in Massachusetts must register and report to the AG's office. So that's just a list of where you want to look when you need to find out what the law says and make sure that you're in compliance. So now I will pass it over to Natalie to talk about the steps of actually forming the entity.
Hi, everybody. Thank you, Alyssa. That was a great recap of all of that, those initial steps. So here we're going to talk about actually forming an entity and what is involved. So there's really going to be three steps here. The first is going to be incorporation with the Secretary of State's office. That's if you're going to be taking a corporate form. And then there's also establishing a trust with the drafting of the actual trust instrument and its initial funding. That's if you're going to be taking a trust form. So that's the first thing we'll talk about. And then we'll get into the application for tax exemption. So once you actually have formed the entity, at that point, then you can apply to the IRS to get tax exemption. And that's done by filing a Form 1023. And then the last step that should be done when forming a tax-exempt organization is to register the organization with the Attorney General's office Usually this is done in the state that the organization is incorporated, but you need to look to the requirements of each state. And usually it's done in any state that the organization does business, which means raising funds from the general public, but that definition can change on state from state to state. So really looking to what each state requires for registration with the Attorney General. So those are the three overall steps. So first we're going to talk about, if we can go to the next slide. The actual forming the incorporation portion. So this is, again, if you're going to be corporate form. So if that's what you're going to be doing, the first step that you need to do is look for the availability of the name of the corporate of the organization. So you're going to want to verify that the name is available with the Secretary of Commonwealth's website. So they have there's a way to search on their website to see if the name is already taken. And there is a rule that the organization cannot have the same name as any other Massachusetts corporation. So there is a place to be able to look for that. And you can reserve the name too, if you would like, on the website. So making sure that the name is available is the first step. And so then there's a bunch of different documents and forms that you're going to want to prepare. And so the first one is going to be the Articles of Organization. And this is going to be a document that's filed with the Secretary of the Commonwealth. And the actual document is a fillable PDF, which is available on the Secretary's website. Just make sure to find the nonprofit corporation form, because there's the for-profit form and the nonprofit form are both there. So just make sure you're getting the correct one. And then once you complete the form, you can either submit it online after you create an account on the website, or you can also just mail in hard copy. So some of the things that they ask about on the form on the Articles of Incorporation that you're going to have to include will obviously be the name of the organization, which again will not be the same as any other organization, any other corporation in Massachusetts. You're going to want to include the charitable purpose, which Alyssa went over a little bit, but again, this is kind of boilerplate 501c3 language that the organization will not be, will be operated exclusively for, you know, religious, charitable, scientific, literary, or educational purposes. But we also want to add in, we suggest that you add in what the organization will actually do. So we do think that you should try to keep it vague and general enough that it'll allow for the evolution of the organization. So saying this purpose, you know, you don't really want to say, that be so specific to say the activities will include increasing literacy among children in Boston. Instead, you might want to say that the activities will include increasing literacy in various communities throughout Massachusetts, because that way, you know, you're capturing geographically, you know, areas that are not just Boston, and you're also not saying that you're increasing literacy among children, because maybe you'll end up doing adult literacy. So just saying that you're increasing literacy generally in communities throughout Massachusetts. You can amend your purpose, your charitable purpose, by filing articles of amendment with the Secretary of State. So if you did want to, you know, make it broader at some point, you could do that, but it would take an amendment with the Secretary of State. And then you also would have to file the amended charter with your 990, which we'll get to, which is a form of a tax return for nonprofits that gets to be filed with the IRS. So there would be two other steps you would need in order to amend this the purpose. The other thing that you're going to want to state is the fiscal year. Usually nonprofits use most recently using the calendar year, so using December 31st. I know a lot of organizations do sometimes also use June 30 as their fiscal year end. It's up to the organization which one they want to use. So you do just need to state what the fiscal year end date will be. And then the names and addresses of your officers and directors. One thing to note is in Massachusetts, this actually, you need to state the residential addresses of your officers and directors. So it can't just be the address of where the organization will be. It actually does require the residential addresses of such people. It is the articles. They do ask for other provisions that are related to the business affairs of the corporation. And so when we usually prepare these articles of organization, we do prepare an addendum that we also submit with the Secretary of State. And it's good to include some boilerplate language there that really is getting to, you know, dissolution, which, as Alyssa mentioned, I don't know that we're going to talk too much about right now during this presentation, but if I think that might even be its own session. But with dissolution, you know, there are certain requirements that certain assets, the assets of a charitable organization, need to go on to another, you know, for other charitable purposes. So that kind of language about dissolution, limitation of liability, certain powers, and restrictions on activities, all that kind of, there's certain language that we like to put in the addendum, because the IRS, when you get to step two of this process, which is asking about it's filing the 1023, they ask you to point to certain provisions in your articles of organization that talk about dissolution and what happens to those assets. So, it's good to be able to point on the 1023 to those specific areas on your articles that talk about that area, that talk about those topics. It is just one thing to note. I think maybe we've had this question before, but you can't file your 1023 until you've actually formed. So you file these amended your articles of organization first. Like, you actually form first before you file your 1023, just as a reminder. Okay, next slide. So the next document that you're going to want to prepare are the bylaws. And there's also going to be a few written policies and two different types of consent. So those five documents are basically your core package. So your articles, your bylaws, depending on where you're incorporating, either three or four different policies, and then the incorporator's consent. So the second document is the bylaws. This really sets forth the responsibilities of the officers and directors and the procedures that will need to be followed throughout the life of the organization. And it's important that the organization follow them. It's kind of the rules of the road is how the organization will operate. They can be amended. They will be amended as provided in the bylaws. So the bylaws will state like what process needs to happen, if notice needs to be given, how, you know, what kind of a vote, is it a vote of the majority that needs to be happen, or a vote of 2/3, and who has the power to amend. All those things will be stated in the bylaws. So that's really a really important document to have. But again, they can always be amended if needed. And so then there's also a bunch of policies that will we always recommend that these policies be drafted, and one actually is required in certain situations. While it's not legally required in Massachusetts, the IRS does ask about a conflict of interest policy on the Form 1023, because basically the IRS wants to know if there is a policy in place for avoiding excess benefit transactions, and that any interested person is disclosing any possible conflicts. So it's good to have adopted for the board to have adopted a conflict of interest policy. So you want to draft that. A whistleblower policy, this is really needed when there's paid employees, but you will want to have one of those to lay out, you know, what the what kind of behavior might be seen, what might be covered by the whistleblower, and what kind of retaliation, you know, basically saying retaliation can't happen, you can't retaliate against a whistleblower. The record retention policy states the procedures and timetables for creation, retention, storage, retrieval, and disposal of records that are within the possession and control of the organization. And so that's one where usually it's the policy asks employees to sign an acknowledgement form every year, agreeing to adhere to the record retention policy. And the last one here is a WISP, which stands for Written Information Security Policy. This policy is required in Massachusetts, and it's required if the organization is holding personal information on Massachusetts residents. And what that means is the organization has Massachusetts resident's name and their social security number or their driver's license or some type of financial account number. So name plus any of those three things. So a lot of nonprofits in Massachusetts will have this type of information. You know, for example, if they have a check for a donation, you know, that'll have a routing number, a bank account number, plus their name. And also employee information. Usually, you know, for tax purposes, you're going to have a social security number plus the name of your employees. So if you're going to be in Massachusetts, if the organization is going to be incorporated in Massachusetts, it's pretty much guaranteed you'll need a WISP. But it also applies for organizations that are not based in Massachusetts that might be soliciting, though, in Massachusetts and gathering Massachusetts residents information. So something to just keep in mind. And then there's two consents that we tend to prepare. One is the incorporator's consent. So this is a set of resolutions where the incorporator takes a few actions, which include approving of the articles of organization. They fix the number of directors. They name the initial directors and adopt the bylaws. So that's the action of the incorporator. And then the initial board consent is a document that is basically, it's a set of resolutions that are acknowledging the incorporation of the corporation, that it was, you know, that it was created. This document also tends to elect the officers, adopts the various policies that I just went over, and it empowers the directors and officers to do certain administrative tasks. So those two things are needed. And the last here is the EIN. So this is an employer identification number. This is provided by the IRS. And so you will need an EIN in order to file your 1023. It's also needed for a bunch of other different tax filings. So in order to get one of these, you will need to incorporate first. So get your formation documents submitted to the Secretary of State's office. Then you would apply on the IRS website to get this EIN number. And you can, as I just mentioned, you can apply either online at the IRS. There's also a form SS4 that you could fill out and submit hard copy if you really wanted. But I think it's much easier to do online because you do get your EIN number pretty much instantly once it's filed. And it's just important to note that once you get this EIN, it does not mean that you're tax exempt with the IRS. This is just an identifying number. That's all it is. It is not your any indication of tax exemption. All right, next slide. So just to kind of go over the advantages and disadvantages of the corporate form. So one advantage of the corporate form is that it does allow for easy engagement of charitable activities and a centralized framework for accountability within the organization. Donors and other nonprofits that maybe you're seeking grants from, they tend to be more comfortable with a corporate form as opposed to like a trust form or maybe a charitable LLC. But those corporate forms, it's a little more comfortable, so they might be more willing sometimes to give to that organization or to serve on the board of that organization. So that is one advantage there. They do also allow for regular turnover in the governing body and the involvement of stakeholders. So because it's corporate form, you know, you have this board of directors and they have a set of their, you know, depending on what the bylaws say, the terms could be 1 year, 2 years, 5 years. And it provides that they shall, you know, hold office for that amount of time. And then, you know, so basically every 5 years, you're going to have a new election. So it really has a structure in place for turnover, which is always a healthy practice. There are some statutory protections, such as limited liability for the directors and officers from personal liability for the corporate activities. So that's always something that can be a good thing. And some of the disadvantages of the corporate form, though, you know, again, there are some corporate formalities. So, you know, board meetings and stuff, things that do need to happen all the time. With some consistency, and then the annual filings that are required with the Secretary of State's office. There's a nominal fee. I want to say it's $15, but I don't want to be quoted on that. But it's especially for nonprofits, it's pretty small. But there are some certain, you know, requirements that kind of ministerial tasks that would have to be dealt with if you're going to be taking the corporate form. And next slide. If you're going to be doing a trust, if you're going to be forming like a trust going into trust form. So I will just say, we don't use the trust form very often. I think Alyssa alluded to this. We usually are only using it when forming a family foundation. So this is very infrequent that we're doing this, but we just wanted to give a very brief overview of what would be included. So in that trust instrument, you would still need to include a charitable purpose. It include the beneficiaries. There's certain 501c3 restrictions, how to amend the trust. That procedure, as in the bylaws for a corporate form, would be here in this trust on how to be able to amend. Additionally, where you don't have, here, you wouldn't have a board of directors. You would have trustees. That would be kind of the governing body, if you would, will. And so certain trustee powers will be outlined in the trust. If there's a power, those all various different powers, they would be in the document. And then the governing law will also be stated, which again, if you're forming in Massachusetts, it'll likely be Massachusetts. And then liability, such as indemnification of the trustees, that may or may not apply. And so that would be in the trust document. You would then need to fund the trust, and also the trust can apply for an EIN. So that would still be, that would hold steady. So you'd still need an EIN in order to apply for your to submit your 1023 and get tax exempt status. And then some advantages and disadvantages of the trust, which are on the next slide. Thank you. So some advantages of trusts are that it can be more appropriate for family trustees who are can be serving indefinitely. So as I mentioned, there's trustees in this form, not board of directors. And so this is where, you know, the instrument, trust instrument, will say so-and-so is the trustee, and they just serve as long as they want, as long as they are alive, whatever that looks like, as it's stated in the trust. And so it's not going to be an election, you know, every 2 or 3 years. So sometimes families like that because they want to be able to serve their entire life as a trustee. So that's why it can be one advantage for families that are going to be forming trusts. There's no annual filings with the Secretary of State because there's no corporate formalities. So you won't have any, you won't have the filings there. So that's good. You will have some others, but not at least not with the Secretary. And then two other things just to note kind of quickly here, it is easier to terminate a trust because some of one of the statutes won't apply here. Where, you know, this is what in chapter 180, section 11A, which basically says that there is no petition for dissolution that needs to be submitted to the AG when there's no assets. And then there's no petition for dissolution with the SJC if there were remaining assets. So you don't have to give that petition for dissolution if you're taking trust form, because that rule doesn't apply to trusts. And then also the section 8A of chapter 180, that notice requirement. So normally, if you're going to be having a sale of all or substantially all of the charitable assets, notice needs to go to the Attorney General when that's going to happen. But that notice requirement to the AG is not necessary if it's trust form. Some of the disadvantages of trusts, it can be an awkward fit for large boards. Again, people tend to be more comfortable with corporate form, as I mentioned earlier. It's just something, so you might have more people willing to serve in that type of governing role. There's a higher default fiduciary duties for trustees. So there are duties that are under the MUTC that they would have to follow, in addition to, so like the duty of care and duty of loyalty that would follow either corporate form or trust form. So that is one disadvantage. And then the last one here is that specifically named charitable beneficiaries may be considered qualified beneficiaries, which means one of the results of this is when a charity is named as a beneficiary, they have to get notice of certain proceedings, like probate proceedings, for example, just like an individual would. And so that can be one disadvantage of a trust, is that they could be considered qualified beneficiary. And I'm going to pass it back over to Alyssa, I think.
Great. Thanks, Natalie. The next topic we're going to cover briefly is fiduciary duties. So fiduciary duties of the governing body of your organization, whether it's trustees or a board of directors and officers. And you'll see that the duties under Chapter 180 are very similar to the duties under the Massachusetts Uniform Trust Act when we list those sections below. But essentially, it's the duty of loyalty and the duty of care. And the duty of care is that your director or trustee must act within a reasonable, as an ordinarily prudent person would employ in a similar position. So what does that mean? You need to show up to meetings. You need to be informed and get information if you don't have it, and commit and show care to the organization. Duty of loyalty means that you need to put the interests of the organization above your own self-interest. So you're always acting in the best interest of the charity and of the charitable mission. The AG's office actually has published a handbook for directors of a nonprofit organization, and they revised this in 2022, I believe. So it should be on their website, and it's a great resource for organizations to have and for them to give their boards or their trustees, that describes in detail sort of what the AG cares about and what these duties mean. And there's a lot of emphasis on sort of paying attention to the finances of an organization, because charities, you know, are usually very leanly staffed, and there's a couple individuals in charge of the finances, which is where people might be able to misappropriate funds. And there is a lot of emphasis on sort of duty to the charitable mission as well. So just something to take a look at, but the MUTC also has similar duties to administer the trust in good faith, duty of prudent administration. So you also have MIFA, so the Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act, which applies to both, but sort of talks about how organizations manage their funds or their endowments, duty to inform and report, and must act solely in the interest of the beneficiaries, which in the case of a trust are usually the public or the communities that you're serving through your mission, or other charities if it's sort of a grant-making organization. And now we're going to get, Natalie went over how to form the actual corporate entity. And now I'll go over quickly sort of how to apply to the IRS for a tax exempt status. So the application to the IRS is called the Form 1023. And I'll talk in a minute on the next slide about sort of the 1023 EZ, which is a shorter form application. But the full application of the 1023, I think, is about 12 pages long, plus a bunch of schedules, depending if they apply to your organization. And a couple of years ago, the IRS made this all, you have to submit it online on their pay.gov portal rather than in paper form. And part of this was an effort to sort of expedite their review, I believe. I'm not sure I've seen that actually happen, maybe in some rare instances. But you do need to sort of create an account and fill out the application on pay.gov. And there are some quirks sometimes in doing so. There's some boxes that have character limits or certain characters that aren't allowed. So you might want to play around a little bit to sort of just get used to that portal and those quirks. There's a $600 filing fee. There used to be two separate filing fees depending on the size of your organization. But now there's just one $600 filing fee that you submit. That you pay when you submit that application. And you, in addition to the sort of online portal, you can attach one PDF that has all of your attachments. So you'll need to attach copies of your organizational documents. But in many cases, if what you want to say, for example, an answer to one of their questions or a description of your activities exceeds the character limit, you probably will also attach a Word document that sort of has all of that extra information that didn't really fit in the online form. So you put that all in one PDF. Depending on who submits it, you might also submit a copy of a signature if the attorney is submitting on behalf of their client, and pay the fee, and it goes out to the IRS. The tax exempt status should be retroactive to the date of the entity's incorporation if it's filed within 27 months of incorporation, which gives you a pretty long time, over 2 years from the date you incorporate to the date that you apply to the IRS. I think I've only bumped up against that deadline a couple of times for various reasons. But what this means is that when the IRS does determine that the entity is 501c3 tax exempt, it is retroactive to the date you formed, which means from the date you form, you sort of have to walk, talk, and act as if you're a C3. So during that time period, you might come past a deadline where you need to actually submit a report to the IRS, even if you haven't heard yet that you're a C3. So you need to be sort of aware of those filing deadlines and dates, and that they need to be complied with, even if you aren't a C3, which is a little funny. You know, we have entities that want to form in late December with a calendar year and fiscal year. And we're sort of like, you can do that, but you're going to need to file a 990 with the IRS for that 1 or 2 week period. You could just wait till January and skip that filing, depending on sort of the circumstances. The application is open to public inspection. Natalie also mentioned this with the corporate filing. When you file your application and all of your IRS annual reports, the 990s are all open, available to the public. The 1023s are a little bit more difficult to find. You can request them from the IRS. The annual reports, the 990s, are published now by the IRS and by another organization called GuideStar.org. So just know that anything you file with the IRS is publicly available. Timing of the IRS response. I've alluded to this a couple of times. So the IRS years ago was very backed up. They came up with a shorter form application and they sort of got rid of some of the backlog, and then COVID hit and staffing issues, and now they're very backlogged again. So Natalie checked as of the 18th of December, the IRS said that it is assigning applications that were submitted April 16th, 2023. So you want to make sure that you and your clients are aware and planning for that, that they probably won't hear from the IRS for at least 6 months. We say you should, you know, plan for 6 to 9 months. I've had a couple come through in 2 months for no rhyme or reason. But you want to make sure that everyone's sort of aware of that. And that's why an organization might work with a fiscal sponsor or might come up with sort of other ways to raise funds during that time, because you can't promise to your donors that you are a 501c3 tax exempt organization. They can't take the charitable deduction until you have that determination in hand. So there is like a gray period. You can open a bank account, you can start operating, and people can donate to you, but you should be very transparent with them that you know, have applied for 501c3 status, you expect to receive it, but that their contributions, they can't take that deduction until the determination letter is in hand. Usually it works out because they wouldn't be filing their taxes till, you know, April of the year following their contribution, but just sort of have a focus on transparency during that period of time. On the 1023 itself, we wanted to point out a couple of the most important sections. Part three asks where the required provisions are in your organizing document. So that is going to ask, where's your charitable purpose? And you literally say it's page one, paragraph two, article three. And where in your organizing documents does it say that upon dissolution, your assets will go to another 501c3? So you're telling the IRS exactly where to find that language, so they know that you're fulfilling those 501c3 requirements. The part four, narrative description of activities, I think is one of that and the financial information, but probably the narrative description is the most important part of the application. That's where your organization or your client's organization is going to explain its past, present, and planned activities and why those qualify for 501c3 status. Generally, I have my clients prepare the first cut of this narrative description. Some of them are very well organized and have, you know, business plans that fit nicely. Some of them need a little guidance on sort of how to prepare that. They might be really talking about the need that they're meeting, but not what they're actually doing and what their activities are. And you want to get into a lot of detail there. And as the attorney, I always think of my job as to preemptively answer any questions, any follow-up questions the IRS might have. Because once you submit your application to the IRS, they could come back with questions. It's not uncommon. They don't always do it, but they might have follow-up questions, which just delays their determination. Usually you always get the C3 determination if you answer their questions and work with them. But I know, for example, if my organization is making grants to foreign organizations, that the IRS wants to know that there are certain things that our organization is going to do to make sure that their funds are being used for charitable purposes, they're not funding terrorist organizations, yada, yada, yada. So you want to get into a lot of detail there. And also, if an organization has activities that it's most likely to conduct in the future, I would probably throw that in there as well, because once the IRS grants the 501c3 status, it's sort of a soft blessing that everything you've described in your application is okay with them. Part five and six talk about compensation and financial arrangements. You know, who are you paying? What types of salaries are you paying? Are your directors and officers also compensated employees? The financial data, new organizations must submit a statement of revenues and expenses for their current year and the good faith estimates for the subsequent 2 years. So the IRS wants to see sort of where is your money coming from? Where is it going to? Does it make sense? Again, these are just good faith estimates because the organization will actually have to file tax returns with the IRS 990s each year showing their actual finances. And I don't think I've ever had the IRS comment on this. So don't get too hung up, or don't have clients get too hung up on sort of figuring out those numbers, as long as they're reasonable and a good representation of what they anticipate. And then part seven is the foundation classification. And that is where you would check the box whether you intend to be a private foundation, a subset, a private operating foundation, a public charity, and how you plan to qualify as a public charity. Again, whether you're a supporting organization, whether you're a school, or whether you plan to pass the public support test. As I mentioned, there is a 1023EZ that is a much more streamlined form that small organizations can use. So organizations that are eligible to use it have to have no more than $50,000 in annual gross receipts and anticipated over the next 3 years, and assets of no more than $250,000. They can't be a church, they can't be an entity other than a corporation, an unincorporated association, or a trust. There's about a 2-page checklist of eligibility requirements that the organization has to check each box to show that it's eligible to file the EZ. Again, the application is on the same online portal with a smaller filing fee, and the same retroactivity applies. But the timing of the IRS response, again, we just checked at the beginning of this week, and the IRS was issuing, I think, determination letters as of November 16th, or for organizations that had submitted their application November 16th. So that's about, 6 weeks ago. So it's much faster. The final comment, lack of in-depth preparation. So, particularly with our pro bono clients, when our time is not a financial consideration, we encourage them to do the full 1023, even if they might fit within that smaller category, because it is a good exercise in having a business plan and thinking about your finances and answering all of these questions that the IRS wants to know, and be able to be in compliance. For organizations that are truly small under that threshold, it might make sense for them to file the EZ and have that quicker turnaround, but they want to really in good faith, they have to sign the application under penalties of perjury, believe that they're not going to exceed that $50,000 threshold. I have had at least a couple of organizations that have exceeded that threshold. And I don't think, I don't know, there's not a lot of information on what the IRS does. You have to then file more fulsome reports with the IRS, forms of the 990. I'm not sure there's any penalties as long as you truly in good faith submitted the EZ. But just a couple of things to think about. And then Natalie, I think I'm back. Yep. Are we back to you on this one? Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yep. And I'm definitely keeping my eye on the clock, so I'll try to go a little quickly here. So the third step here we're talking about in the process is the registration to solicit. You have to register in order to solicit, especially in the state of Massachusetts. So here you're going to be registering with the Attorney General's Public Charities Division. And the initial registration, I'll go through what it looks like, that initial registration, if your first fiscal year has not yet been completed. If the first fiscal year has passed, you can still register and should still register. It's just that there's more documentation that will be required, including a copy of your 990. But this is, again, if the fiscal year has not yet been completed. So one change to note is that this initial registration is now only done online. You used to be able to submit hard copy, and they also give you the choice of hard copy or filing online. As of, I believe, last fall, they said you have to do this online. So if you go to the Public Charities Division of the Attorney General's website, there's a registration form. You complete that form, and then they ask you to upload certain documents, your organizing documents, the current list of officers and directors, again, with their residential addresses. And if you've received your determination letter from the IRS that you are tax exempt, they ask for a copy of that. If you have not received it, you just say you applied, but you haven't received it yet. So you can do all that, and you do that first step, and everything gets submitted. And then once it's submitted to the Attorney General's office, a charity specialist then reaches out to you via email. They give you an AGO number, which is kind of like your identification number, with further instructions, because there may be additional forms that they or documents that you may need to upload. But then once you have that AGO number, then you can go ahead and create an online account with the Public Charities Division. And this is where you're going to pay the registration fee of $100. And this is where you're going to complete, you know, any other of those required documents that they may have said in that initial email, like, oh, we need a copy of what, you know, maybe your last 990 for some reason or whatever. And this portal is also where you're going to be submitting annual filings with the Attorney General, like your Form PC. So the Form PC is kind of the equivalent to a 990, but it's submitted to the Massachusetts Attorney General's office rather than the IRS. And so all those things are done on this online portal now. And if you wish to solicit funds, there's an additional Schedule A2 that has to be filed with the Attorney General, because some organizations aren't going to be soliciting. But if you do solicit funds, you need to pay an additional filing fee and submit that form. And again, just keep in mind, if you're going to be doing business or soliciting in other states, you need to look at the requirements of registering in other states with other Attorney General's offices, because they vary state to state. Next slide. And so there's also ongoing reporting that should be done. This again applies to Massachusetts organizations. So the first thing that would have to be that's required is an annual report is due to the Massachusetts Secretary of State by November 1st of every year. And that's a $15 filing fee. So that may have been the $15 I referred to earlier. So I'm glad I wasn't quoted on that number. So the annual report, again, yeah, you can find this online on the Secretary of State's website. It really is like asking for the date of your last annual meeting, the names and addresses of directors and officers, and when their terms expire. So it's pretty short. It's not a very in-depth form or report, but it is due annually. And then again, the Attorney General's office that we were just talking about, there are some forms that are due there every year. So the first being the Form PC. This is due on the 15th day of the fifth month after the fiscal year end. And the filing fee that will be associated is going to be based on the gross support and revenue of the organization. So the more revenue that they have, the higher the filing fee will be. And again, check the requirements of other states in which the organization is registered, because if they're registered, let's say in California, there might be other annual filings that are due there. And then as far as, and just so you know, with the Form PC, some of the information that they're looking for there, they're looking for the organization's financial data, compensation info, whether funds are solicited, and again, the names and addresses of officers and directors, and if there was any sale or transfer of assets. So that's kind of some of the information they're looking for. That one's a little bit in depth, but not difficult to you know, necessarily difficult. It is just more in depth than the annual report that's due to Secretary of State. And then with the IRS, there's always that annual 990, which is the tax return for organizations. Depending on the assets of the organization, you might be able to file a 990EZ or a 990N if there's no assets. And then the 990PF is for private foundations. So they have their own specific Form 990. And this is the same due date as the Form PC with the Attorney General's office. So again, this is due to the IRS the 15th day of the fifth month after the fiscal year end. One thing to note here is that if an organization does not file their 990 or 990EZ or 990N, if they don't file a Form 990 for 3 consecutive years, then their tax exempt status will be automatically revoked. And so you want to make sure that your client is aware that they have these filing requirements with the IRS, because you do not want to lose the tax exempt status. It can be reinstated, but it's a process, and we would not recommend going through the revocation. So make sure that you get those in on time. And I think that's pretty much it. There, we have some resources here. The IRS's website has some resources, the Corporation Secretary of State's office and the Attorney General, with these hyperlinks. And if you have any questions, I know we didn't have to leave a ton of time for questions, but if you do have questions, feel free to reach out to either Alyssa or myself. Our emails are right here. And then our last slide is just some upcoming dates for some of the additional programs being offered by the VBA. So just a reminder on some of those. And Alyssa, do you have anything else to add?
No, we finished exactly on time. And I don't see any Q&A comments, but we'll stay on for another few seconds in case anyone has any questions on what we said. But we do encourage you to continue to attend the programs because they'll get a little more in depth on some of the items that we discussed today and are very informative.
Thanks, everyone.
Happy holidays.